You want to guess which scene this is, Rob, that where people burst into applause?
Well, I don't know. I hesitate to hazard a guess.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. It's been a long time since we podcasted.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say it's been a long time since we've talked, but we actually have talked a lot more recently and frequently than the last time we podcasted.
It's like we actually live in the same city. It's quite amazing.
I know. And sometimes go to movies.
And sometimes actually see two movies, like we did this past last weekend.
Two movies that were... I hadn't read much about either of them, actually, but that are acclaimed, that have great casts, and yet... One of them is great. One of them is terrible.
Yeah, it's for better or worse, we agree on both of those. There's not a lot of won't be a lot of conflict in our podcast today. Although maybe we'll find ways to argue with our with other people who like the second movie more than we do.
Yeah.
So, but let's start with the first one, with which we both love and everyone loves because it's fantastic and everyone should go see it. And that's Lady Bird, the Greta Gerwig written and directed movie. For people who don't know Greta Gerwig, she's much better known as an actress. Been in a lot of indie films like Frances Ha, and I particularly like her in an earlier film called Greenberg with Ben Stiller. I don't know if you'd seen that one.
Yeah.
And then the very first movie I think I saw her in was Baghead, which I think we actually podcasted about a long time ago.
Baghead is one of those Duplass. It's one of the best Duplass brothers films, I think. Yeah. And I'm always hopeful that they'll do things like that. A real genre experiment and tons of fun. And I forgot until I sort of went back and was reviewing her credits that she was one of the four. Mm-hmm. It's two couples in that. That was a cool rediscovery.
Yeah, and she has... Yeah, she has amazing screen presence and wonderful charisma, and so it's always pretty much she's great in everything she's in. But I remember when I found out, I don't know, a few months ago, several months ago, that she was directing a movie, I said, oh, well, we'll see how that goes. That transition always isn't the easiest thing for actors. But this movie is just great. A few things about it, just to, if people don't know anything about it, it's set in Sacramento in 2002-2003, which... coincidentally or not, is sort of when Greta Gerwig was growing up, that's where she lived in about that right time in her high school years. So this feels a little like a personal movie, a movie maybe at least somewhat autobiographical. And Saoirse Ronan, who probably most people, if they know her as an actress, know her from the movie Brooklyn, which came out a couple of years ago and is I also think is great, plays the title character. She has this nickname that she goes by, Lady Bird. Some people call her that, her parents and her teachers, not so much. But it's about her senior year of high school and her hope of getting out of Sacramento and going to someplace far away and experiencing life. In a certain level, it's just about that year in school. But I think it's much more than that. What did you like about it, Rob?
I thought the whole thing was just lovely. I mean, whenever this type of film, this sort of slice of a person, young person's life at a pivotal moment in their life, when it's done well, it almost seems like it's hard to detect what's so good about it because it just feels so real. And it's so easy to go off the rails in many ways, you know, in any direction. I mean, for one thing, you mentioned that she's an actor. Greta Gerwig is an actor. And so this is her first film that she wrote and directed. And I have a feeling that she was, you know, one of the auteurs in some of the films that she's done with Noah Baumbach and others. Mm-hmm. But this is the first one that, you know, she's billed as the writer and director, of course. And sometimes that's tricky. When other actors have tried to do that, I always feel like the common mistake is that acting is overemphasized in that film, you know, at the expense of everything else that you could do with cinema. And in this film, one of the things that's great about it is the performances and the rapport with actors and the casting. The cast is just uniformly great, just across the board, large characters and small characters. And so in that sense, the fact that you have an actor behind the camera is probably a huge asset but mm-hmm. it wasn't the extent of the skill that's on display here. You know, it's just a beautiful film in lots of ways, which we can talk about. But we might as well start with that cast. I mean,
yeah, it's fantastic.
She doesn't appear in the film, first of all, nope. which is an interesting choice, probably. But yeah, Saoirse Ronan as Lady Bird, the title character, is just great. And I didn't see Brooklyn, and I hadn't seen her in anything before, and I sort of liked that this was my first look at this actor and this character. But I just felt like it was she was completely believable, at this age, and in ways that are not just the way it's acted, but in the way it's written, that she's aware of a lot of the world, but you can also see all these holes in her knowledge. But she's aware that she has these holes and doesn't want to reveal that, you know, like someone mentions Jim Morrison to her and she's like, oh yeah. And then later she asks someone, who's Jim Morrison? You know, which you'd expect sometimes characters in movies are sort of knowing beyond their years, you know, how could you possibly know all these things that we as the, you know, older audience know. But, there were lots of things like that. She's not very experienced in the world yet. And she has this good relationship with a friend,
Julie.
Yeah.
Who's played by Beanie Feldstein, and she's great. One of the things that this movie strangely reminded of was the Spider-Man movie that came out this summer, which is not like some masterpiece, but it's really nice in the way it portrays teen characters, and in particular, it portrays the kind of teen characters that don't often show up in movies. Kids who are, you know, overweight, or kids who aren't just the most beautiful people in their class, and in both that movie, but especially here in Lady Bird, a lot of the characters are just kind of normal looking, and there's something really wonderful about that, I thought.
Yeah, the parents, Laurie Metcalf and Tracy Letts, are complicated and loving but flawed in their own ways, you know. And her brother is a funny sort of foil who's still living at home.
Yeah.
And just the universe is peopled with real people. One thing I thought was interesting that we should talk about is that she goes to a Catholic school, and the administrators and teachers there are nuns and priests and, you know, people, elders in the Catholic Church. And there are lots of cliches that you could fall into here. But universally,
which by the way, the second movie we're going to talk about does fall
certainly
into.
Does. But in this case, these teachers were invested in these students. They were really they cared. Some of them, I felt like the casting was so great with like the theater teacher. It just the look on his face, and the exposition and the character development too. From the very first time we see him, when she comes on stage to audition, and he calls her, you know, Christine McPherson, and she says Lady Bird, and he said, "Is Lady Bird your given name?" And she says, "Yes, I gave it to myself, you know." And here's the thing that I like, though. He accepts that, and he says, "All right, sure. Lady Bird McPherson." You know, it tells us something right off the bat about him.
Yeah.
But it just the look of his face as well. He has a very loving kind of face, and he's a very nurturing kind of a teacher, which we see many times. And there are just lots of examples. Not that any of them are these awe-inspiring teachers who somehow were the one person to reach this student. None of them were that.
Right.
But they were a support system in her life, and cared, and were interesting characters in their own right. And I really appreciated that. And that was true just across the board.
Yeah, it really is. It's so nice when a movie invests what clearly is care and time in the small characters, because it makes the whole world feel alive, and it makes it seem... use the word believable a couple times. I think that's exactly right. It feels like we know these people, and everything they say rings true. It's like, yeah, that character would say that, or that character would respond in that way. And that extends not just to the main character and her friends, but to these, you know, these teachers and these other people that she meets. And I really like that about the movie.
Yeah. Well, and as a screenplay and as a writer of the film, I love the way she knew what to include and how briefly or how long, how much to explore. You know, there are hints about teachers' lives outside of what the students see, and I feel like she knows just how to reveal that, but not dwell on it and move on and leave some mysteries there. She did this thing several times, which is there's an editing term for this, I think, J cut or L cut. I think it's the L cut, where the sound from one scene continues on as you move to a completely different scene. And it's just a subtle thing. It's not the sort of thing you'd want to overdo, but if done carefully and judiciously, it connects things thematically, I think that would otherwise might just be different. And of course, like just a cat in itself can do that. But whenever you further connect it with some sound, it lets you draw parallels between things that you might not otherwise. And I felt there were, you know, there's a character who we find out is gay, similar to another something that is the teacher is that one of the teachers is going through. Has caused him to leave his job, and we don't know anything about that, but it sort of plants that idea in your head about, well, maybe there are similar struggles going on here, that there are private lives, whether it's, who knows what it is, but there are private lives that people live that they try to contain or can't contain and are unsure how to deal with other people when those things come out. And so I just love that little sort of every person is having their own struggle. Mm-hmm. And we should talk about her parents as well, because that's a lot more fleshed out.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you bringing up the editing, though, because I thought the same. I wasn't thinking about it so much in terms of sound editing, but I found the editing of the movie, the way it cuts from scene to scene, pretty interesting, because sometimes a scene will linger a little bit longer than I would expect, and sometimes it cuts a little bit earlier than I would expect, and it's not that it draws attention to itself, you know, in a kind of, you know, hey, look at me way, but I found it just sort of kept me as a viewer on my toes, and I found that interesting and enjoyable. But you were talking about the parents, and again, Laurie Metcalf is one of my favorite actors. I think she's just really fantastic. She's a little bit typecast, I think, from her time on the TV show Roseanne. But when she gets a really meaty role, she just makes it her own, and she really, I thought, this is fabulous in this movie, and particularly the relationship that the mother and daughter have is for me the real central highlight of the film. There's this one scene in particular where they're going out shopping for a prom dress, and at one point Laurie Metcalf's character says, you know, I want you to be the best version of yourself, and there's this kind of pause, and then Lady Bird, who's in the dressing room, kind of says from behind the door, but what if this is the best version? Which, of course, is a great response, just as a kind of as a teenage response of, you know, maybe this is all I can be. But Laurie Metcalf's reaction to that, and her sort of a facial expression, was maybe my favorite single moment in the movie, because it's this moment of she rolls her eyes a little bit, but then she kind of realizes, wow, that's a really tough thing for my daughter to say. And there's a vulnerable thing for her to say. And there's something really profound about that, of how teenagers worry that maybe this is the best I can be. You know, maybe this idea that I can, you know, be whoever I want to be just isn't true. And the way Laurie Metcalf kind of responds to that, I thought was really beautiful and just a really sort of pivotal moment in the film, at least for me.
Yeah, but also true to the character, who is
absolutely
struggling to you know, get her daughter on track and get her going to a good school, but also accepting of her, of what she has in life. They have a real sort of fraught relationship, but I think you're right that it does become the central one. Out of all the relationships and pairs that the movie is made up of, that's sort of the one that lingers over the end and becomes, I think, the spine of the movie. And
yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Rob.
No, yeah, I think you're right about Laurie Metcalf, too, that she has a way of conveying this. She's so gruff and passive-aggressive, and this so irritates Lady Bird. But you can also understand why, and you can see what's really behind that, and you wish that she could somehow show it better or something. But and she's trying. But all of that is sort of conveyed in just her face, her expressions, what we see when Lady Bird's not around, or what we see when she is and she's holding back, but she can't hold back, or whatever, you know, it comes out in all these different ways.
And I love how the story portrays this relationship, because a lot of times in a movie like this, between, you know, where you have a mother and daughter or parent child relationship, there's a narrative arc that's going to move from, you know, not understanding to understanding. And there's a little bit of that in this movie for sure. But throughout the movie, you have these moments where the two of them are really sort of, you know, arguing or irritated with each other, or even being a little nasty with each other. But they almost sometimes very quickly then find the things that they love about each other. And that rang true to me as well. That's a sense that it's, you know, a lot of times in parent-child relationships, you can have the frustration and the love sort of right alongside each other. And it's not that you have to have this moment of catharsis to get from bad to good. Bad and good just, you know, often is kind of tied up together.
They intertwine. And, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, one example that comes right to mind is the when her boyfriend comes over and he jokes that, wow, Lady Bird said she lived on the other side of the tracks, and I literally did drive across the tracks to get here. Well, there are lots of class issues in the story, but this just really pierces her mother's heart and she brings it up with her later. How could you say that about where we live, that we live on the wrong side of the tracks? You know, and that's an example of what you're talking about, where she's insulted that this would happen, but also it's because she wants to have provided something good for her daughter, and she wants her daughter to have recognized this and recognized that what they have is fine. You know, it's they may be living paycheck to paycheck and struggling sometimes, but they have a roof over their heads and they have a nice family. And like you say, it just they go hand in hand. They're two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. And it's so telling that, and I appreciate you bringing up this idea of class, which is sort of central, but it's telling that towards the end of the movie, they're wanting to spend time together, and they say, let's do the thing we always love to do. And there's a brief pause, and I was remembering in the movie, I was thinking, oh, what do they love to do together? You know, and what they love to do is to go to open houses of nice houses and pretend like they might actually buy this house. And I said, oh, that's fantastic. What a wonderfully unique and yet telling thing that they love to do together.
Well, and it fits with things we've heard Lady Bird say about how she loves this one particular house that's on the other side of the tracks, of course.
That's right.
A beautiful looking house. And that turns out there are kids at school who live in that neighborhood or on that street, and all that is a complicated aspirations.
Yeah.
I was curious what you thought of Tracy Letts as the dad. He's a very warm character, and I thought it was another case of good casting there.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously, in a movie that's not even 2 hours, it's not even close, actually, there's only so much time you have for every character. And so I wish his could have been fleshed out a little bit more. But he's delightful when he's on screen. And again, it's a nice counterpoint to you can imagine him and Laurie Metcalf's character being married. And you can also imagine the way the good cop, bad cop relationship has developed over the years, where Tracy Letts is the, you know, he's always the one who kind of comes to comfort Lady Bird, and he never has to be the bad guy, which at one point, you know, Laurie Metcalf's character calls him out for. It's like, you know, you always get to be the good guy here, and I never am. And I thought that was really, you know, again, just a nice part of the film.
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Yeah. And I think you also see there are times when he is swallowing his pride, holding back, you know, his thoughts, or his wife reveals to Lady Bird things that are hurtful to him or that are painful to him that he hasn't let on, because he seems like just an amiable, warm guy there to support his daughter. And I think that's all good writing, and supported by the actors, of course. And I was also thinking about how we were talking about Greta Gerwig being an actor who has written and directed this. Tracy Letts himself is an outstanding playwright, Pulitzer Prize winner. And his plays, I don't know if people know this, but they almost always premiere here in Chicago at Steppenwolf. Mm-hmm. And he's on kind of a tear right now, like one a year. But the last two I saw were just fantastic. And they were very small scale character studies. One of them was about a woman, sort of her entire life. So it was broad in the sense that it was about a life, but it was focused on a particular woman. And then the second more recent play was about a man in his, a middle-aged man in the era of Trump, which was, which is interesting. And then he has one now that's premieres, maybe already has. I'm supposed to see it in a couple of weeks. I always try to catch them.
Lucky you.
Yeah, he's a great playwright, and I always try to catch them. But he's also an actor, prolific actor, and he's been on stage and TV and movies. And I think the casting someone who is not only an actor here, but also is aware of storytelling, and especially in plays where you have to elide so much because you have so little, and you count on pauses and spaces and what's not said. Yeah. I feel like it paid dividends here with his performance, which I thought was great, even in a sort of a sparsely drawn role.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, one thing that I thought would be interesting to explore too is the religion in the film, because obviously she's at a Catholic school, so we see elements of that just in her daily life that she doesn't necessarily take seriously at school. It's just a part of, you know, their, she's lying with Julie on the floor, chatting while they're eating communion wafers.
You know? That's right.
Hey, we're not supposed to be eating those. And someone says, and she crunches, you know, her response. Things like that are funny, but we also see them, you know, we see them in the sanctuary, you know, the, mm-hmm. we see them in worship, and it's a part of her life. And sometimes this, I realize as we're talking about this movie that it feels like it's really packed with class issues and mother, daughter, and father, mm-hmm. and friends, and religion. And it is actually, when I lay it all out, but it's a testament to the screenplay and the directing is how it doesn't feel that way at all. It feels airy and natural. Yep. And I think one of the ways that it does that is that with a topic like this that is sort of fraught with cliche on lots of sides, like the movie could lean toward, well, this is a really repressive environment for her, or something like that. Or it could lean toward, well, it becomes a deep and meaningful guide for her life. And I don't really think it does either of those. But I think that where she ends up leaving, going to college, kind of trying to stake out a new path, change. She's always had this name that she's insisted on, and now this quirky name has almost become stale. And so she tells someone her name is Christine, and she's from Sacramento. Where? San Francisco. She says she's inventing her life before our eyes, you know, in the noise of a party. And yet she feels detached from her family and feels that loss as they do feel her loss on their side, which is revealed in a really beautiful way involving letters that weren't sent. But where she goes after that, I found really interesting, which was to the church there in where she is. And I don't feel like it was that she's drawn to God in that moment. I feel like she's drawn to the community and the family that all of that represents, that it was all tied together in that way.
Yeah, and I think the only thing I'd add to that is I think she's tied to the ritual, or attracted to the ritual.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the sort of, one of the things the movie doesn't spend a lot of time, but, you know, takes seriously is sort of just the rituals of a Catholic school. And you get the sense that when she gets to New York, that she finds comfort in that. You know, it may not have any meaning beyond just that it's a ritual, but she seems to enjoy it, and it reminds her of home.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
No, but I think you're right that there's so much in this movie, and yet it doesn't feel like like a heavy movie. There's, I like your adjective, airy. There's a sense of openness, I think, about the movie that I really like. That it can find your own place in it depending on what you want to focus on. And there's a lot there, but it doesn't sort of force you in any interpretation or understanding. You're experiencing this year with Lady Bird in I think a really profound and beautiful way.
Yeah, it's a fantastic debut, and I'm really looking forward to what she does next.
Yeah, absolutely. You and I had almost the exact same reaction to this movie, which is the exact opposite reaction of most of our fellow critics. So Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri stars Frances McDormand. And whatever we say about this movie, I think I want to point out that Frances McDormand is great. She's a great actress, and she's really good in this. But it's a movie... Well, where to start? She's a mother, and the title of this movie is about these three billboards that she puts up at the very beginning of the movie. Her daughter, several months before, was raped and killed in a particularly brutal fashion, and for reasons that we find out fairly quickly, her killer has not been found. There's been no movement, so it's an unsolved case, Frances McDormand's character just finds this both revolting and outrageous. And so she buys three billboards on a fairly remote road, but not so remote that people in the town won't hear about them. And they just say, raped while dying and still no arrests. how come Chief Willoughby? And Chief Willoughby, of course, is the police chief, and she's trying to sort of spur him on or provoke him to take this case seriously. Well, it certainly spurs him and provokes him as well as everyone else in the town. And that then sets off a whole series of confrontations in the film between her and a whole series of people. So,
and a whole series of scenes, not one of which is subtle.
No.
I think back wistfully to the first few scenes when I was trying to figure out how closely to be paying attention to all the subtle details in this. Because I went in knowing nothing really about the film other than I think I had seen the trailer. Knew the cast, but didn't otherwise hadn't read anything about it. Didn't know what to expect exactly. But there's a guy in an ad agency who's reading Flannery O'Connor's "A Good Man Is Hard to Find," and that's it's hammered pretty heavily. Like, okay, we're definitely supposed to notice that. Are we also supposed to notice that he's turned pretty far into the book, so he's past that story and he's well into another story? Who knows? I don't know. I'm looking at that like, oh, I'm thinking, this premise so far doesn't make any sense. The billboards are, falling apart. They're on a road that no one ever takes anymore. They're not even maintained. When she goes in and tries to buy them, they don't know, this agency doesn't even remember that they have them. And yet somehow they're going to be expensive, or somehow they're going to have a big effect when no one sees them. Was just a strange thing. But at this point, I was still ready to believe that. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember when I fell off of wanting to like them, like the movie, but it was fairly early on. I hope I wasn't a negative influence to the people around me for slapping my forehead three times as we went, but I don't know where to even begin. It's just, the whole thing is preposterous. I felt like I could predict the ending fairly on, not specifically what was going to happen, but I could predict that it was going to be tasteless and ridiculous. And I think I hit that.
It's a frustrating film because it is a great cast. And I think on the whole doing good work. I mean, I think Frances McDormand is really good with what she has to work with. I think Woody Harrelson as the police chief is, I've become a big Woody Harrelson fan over the last 10 years. I think most of the things he does are at least interesting. Sam Rockwell as this kind of racist, ridiculous cop. I mean, he's incompetent. But Sam Rockwell is still really good, and it makes me at least somewhat intrigued by his character.
Sort of, although I was trying to figure out, is Sam Rockwell as disillusioned by this film as everybody else, and he's playing in some other universe? He doesn't seem to take a single scene seriously, and in some ways it does make him, it is one of the more interesting things about the movie, is that it's like he's a loose cannon, the actor, in some ways. What in the world is he doing here?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we should probably try to address is, I was reading a bunch of reviews. This is one of those movies where I so disagree with typical critical opinion. I actually wanted to read a bunch of reviews just to see what people liked. And everyone mentions that it's a very dark comedy. And I just didn't find it funny. I found parts that I could tell were probably trying to be funny. Yeah. But I didn't laugh, and the more a scene or a particular line of dialogue tried to be funny, the more kind of uncomfortable I found it, just because it didn't work for me. Did you find it funny at all?
I found that it was trying to be funny. There were lots of things, that jokes that fell flat, that were just broad comedy. They weren't at all, someone sees someone else pulling a knife on someone in a really ridiculous situation. It's like, oh, I can see you're busy here. I'll just go wait in the car. You know, that kind of humorous. it's barely even a joke. But yeah, this is mixed with, cancer and suicide and maudlin strings on the soundtrack. Mm. And it's like, I don't think that you can excuse the ridiculousness of the story and the characters with just by calling it a black comedy. But yeah, I didn't find anything funny at all.
I sometimes wonder, I remember I had an argument with Scott Tobias, who used to write for The Onion and then The Dissolve, and now is sort of a freelancer par excellence. But I argued with Scott that I thought that the environment in which you saw a movie, especially a comedy or a movie that's trying to be funny, might affect how you look at it. And so if you saw a screening, with an audience that was really enjoying a movie and particularly was laughing a lot, then I think you would find the movie itself much more enjoyable and funny than if you saw it in a screening where, no one seems to be having a good time or no one is laughing. And I wonder if maybe, I think this movie premiered at Toronto. I wonder if just somehow the screenings in Toronto were really positive and people laughed a lot. And that led to this kind of groupthink that this movie is actually a comedy. Because, you know, certainly Einar's screening was, you know, lightly attended, I'd say, what, maybe 20 people in the theater.
Yeah, if that.
But I don't think there was a single moment of laughter in the entire 2 hours that we were there from anyone. And that would, you know, that would certainly affect both ways. I think that affects how you would see a movie.
I think it can, just in the abstract, I think it definitely can. I remember seeing David Cronenberg's The End of Violence. No, what's the David Cronenberg film with...
there's Eastern Promises. There's
the one before that.
End of Violence, is it?
A History of Violence. End of Violence.
Oh, is, History of Violence,
End of Violence,
that's right.
Is Wim Wenders, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I remember seeing the David Cronenberg film, A History of Violence, in an audience that was responding to it in a really interesting way. This was in Toronto, too, I think. And it was... It affected what I thought of the film because I felt like he's playing these people like a fiddle, you know? And I really appreciated that. Or I remember seeing Luis Buñuel's Land Without Bread in San Francisco, and I thought a couple of people were going to get in a fight over over the film. That'd be interesting to talk about sometime. But those are sort of extreme cases where it's fun to see. It's not only fun to see what's on the screen, but it's fun to see what it's doing to the people in the audience. And I certainly think it could happen that, you know, if everybody's laughing, you can be caught up in that, even if you're, you know, the objective film viewer. And I actually kind of wonder that about this film, too, about whether it had a really warm screening in Toronto or something. Who knows? Maybe people just genuinely like it better. It's also possible that Martin McDonagh, the filmmaker, just has a strong enough reputation that people went in hoping for something better and sort of saw enough to latch on to. I looked in Bruges, his first film. I think he's better known as a playwright, and I haven't seen any of his plays. It's kind of interesting that that's an echo of what we were just talking about with Lady Bird.
Yeah, it's true.
But he made In Bruges, which I saw at Sundance. I don't think I've seen it since, but I remember really liking it. And that is a dark comedy and a very funny, funny film. And I wonder if translating or transplanting a story to Ebbing, Missouri was part of what felt off here. Because this doesn't, I mean, I grew up in Missouri, lived there. All my family lives there. I'm there every year. And there are, I'm sure, plenty of racist attitudes in rural Missouri, but they don't sound and look like this to me. I didn't want to hold that necessarily against it because I don't actually know if there is an Ebbing, Missouri, but this, as far as I'm concerned, it could be just some fictional place. It doesn't matter. It's not Georgia, despite the Flannery O'Connor at the beginning, but still it didn't feel authentic to me. And I wondered if that was a part of what was off-putting to it for me. But it just felt like every turn, every scene, would take some turn that was just like, I can't believe that this is what's happening. I can't believe we're doing this. Where Woody Harrelson has written these letters, which we hear from beyond the grave, and the one he writes for Sam Rockwell, the cop, when he says, I see a good cop in you. I feel like, well, that's just good character development. But not for Sam Rockwell, for Woody Harrelson's character. He's a nincompoop. I never realized it until this moment that he was this bad. Maybe he was an enabler all this time because that guy, that violent, racist, sexist, homophobe with the patience of a kindergartner doesn't belong anywhere near a police station.
No.
And I think I think that's borne out later too. When this is a weird one. I asked you this right afterward. He concocts this plan. He's been kicked out of the force, luckily, by a guy who comes in to take over. A guy from The Wire. I forget the actor's name, but he's great and unfortunately marginalized in this. But of course, he fires Sam Rockwell. How can you not fire a guy who walks across the street and throws somebody out a 2-story window for no reason?
No, and then not only throws him out of the two-story window, but proceeds to, like, beat him up in the middle of the street while everyone watches.
Right.
It's
absurd.
I mean, not to interrupt you, but there's the way this movie uses violence is so strange because the movie's sort of realistic. I mean, in the way, you know, at least it's trying, I think, to be. And yet people are just violent in just the most bizarre ways. And there are no consequences. You know, at one point, Frances McDormand, you know, firebombs the police station. Everyone knows she's firebombed the police station. And yet nothing happens. You know, nobody does anything about it. You know, Sam Rockwell is kicked off the force because he throws a guy out of a two-story window and then proceeds to, like, brutally beat him on the street afterwards. But it's not like he is even arrested for that.
That's just Dixon for you.
Yeah. It's just get weird. Out. But anyway, I'm sorry, Rob, I interrupted you. But there's lots of moments like another moment. Sorry, I just have to rant here. But like the moment where the movie really started to lose me is Frances McDormand goes to the dentist. And the dentist is giving her a hard time about these billboards. And so she just takes the dentist's drill and jams it into his thumb.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Are we supposed to laugh at this? I mean, and then, of course, you know, nothing happens. There's no repercussions for this at all. It's like the police chief says, well, you've had a hard time and let you go on this one. It's like, what the heck?
Well, she denies it. She at least knows to deny it. I didn't do that.
Well, I guess that's right. But, the dentist slipped. He did it to himself. It's just so weird the way the violence works in this movie where there's just, I think it's being played for laughs, but it's not funny. It doesn't do anything for the characters except to just make this town seem the most bizarre place in the world.
Yeah.
But anyway, you were going in a different direction than I.
Only that Sam Rockwell does actually get fired from the force, but then he's going to redeem himself and concocts this plan to get into a bar fight, scrape some DNA off of this guy's face, and they're going to ID this guy. And the sergeant comes in and says, "You done good. You done real good." And I don't understand that line because then he proceeds to tell him, "We got no evidence whatsoever. It's not the guy." So, all right, you did. You attempted to do good. You attempted to do real good. You could have said, "Get out! Get out!" I don't know. The whole thing makes not a lick of sense. Nothing.
Oh, mercy.
It's bizarre.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about sort of how a crowd would react. One of the reviews I wrote said that there was a scene in which people burst into applause. You want to guess which scene this is, Rob? That where people burst into applause.
Well. I don't know. I hesitate to hazard a guess.
It's the scene. There's a scene to go back to our earlier point about religion and especially cliches of Catholicism. It's the scene when Frances McDormand's character comes home and the local priest is sitting in her dining room, and he's sort of giving her a hard time about these billboards and how she should just kind of let it go. And, you know, good God, the police chief is dying of cancer. Can't she see that? And her response is to make this rather long-winded analogy about sort of the Catholic, pedophile scandal, which, I mean, and apparently this is supposed to be a real zinger, but anyone who's watching can see this, you know, where this is going. Even before she starts to say it, we know where she's going. But somehow, apparently, this provoked a huge round of applause in the screening room where the critic was.
Okay,
which I just that to me is one of the, in a film full of weak scenes, that was one of the weaker ones, just because it's so obvious where it's going, and it's I don't know, I just found it really frustrating.
Yeah, I don't think you want to hitch your moral wagon to Mildred on this one or anything. I mean, really. And I do like that, you know, I don't even know what it's trying to do in the end, but it does at least offer some doubt about whether they're doing the right thing to go, you know, murder the person they're going to murder. Mm-hmm. it's a small, they threw us a bone, I suppose, but that it's, I don't know, it was a long way to get there.
Another thing I do like about the movie, and I think that the movie is trying to do this and it sort of succeeds at least in this, is the movie does try to show just the real damage that can happen from grief, and particularly grief where you think you have a role to play, or, you know, a tragedy that's happened that you think you have a role to play, and then just the difficulty of working through that. And so in that sense, I think the movie is trying to capture that and does to some degree. So I think the movie at least somewhat succeeds on that level, at least raising that issue of, when something really terrible happens, what do you do? And some people react really badly. Some people, desperate from some kind of resolution, will go to, really horrible lengths to try to get that resolution. And I think the movie recognizes that, and I think that's worth applauding. I would say, but it I think the movie is I enjoyed that part of it.
It's something, yeah, and it's at least we can't expect that everyone's going to behave calmly and rationally in all situations, right. And that it might be an interesting story if you had sort of counteracting, you know, impulses that weren't positive, you know, or that
right.
were sort of finding each other's worst side and bouncing off of it. It just felt mm-hmm. so ginned up here for
yes.
for to have some kind of explosive on the screen. I have a hard time even explaining how it arrived at this point. I came away feeling like it was one of the worst you know, mainstream films, American films I've ever seen in a theater. Mm. I think that was probably hyperbole just coming out, probably the contrast with having just seen Lady Bird, you know, minutes, but we went mm-hmm. back to back on these two. But also that, you know, I've seen a lot of half-baked movies, of course, in my life. But usually by the time they get kind of this far, there is a certain sort of sameness that's flushed out of even the worst movies. Where this one, I guess that's one interesting thing about it is how in the world did it get this far mm-hmm. with all of these strange rough edges and oddities? And that there may be a story there. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful cast. And I really yeah. feel like you could take this cast and you could even take many elements of this story and make a really great, weird, gritty, all kinds of different movies from those elements, I feel like. And I don't know how they ended up with this one.
Yeah. No, I think you're right, though, that the cast is sort of what doesn't redeem the movie, but it at least sort of explains how it got to this point. Because it does, you know, they are able to take, you know, some of the most ridiculous scenes and not exactly make them work, but they... at least I found myself sometimes thinking about them. What I found particularly frustrating about the film is that there are several points in the movie where I thought, oh, okay, maybe the movie's going to go somewhere interesting here. Maybe we're finally going to, you know, have something that is not just, you know, ridiculous. But no, I mean, immediately it just sort of, you know, ups the ante of ridiculousness. Mm-hmm. You know, there literally, I don't think is a full solid minute of subtlety in the entire movie.
No.
you know, at the moment when someone actually starts to think or when you actually have an interesting interaction, like I found the interactions between Mildred and her ex-husband sort of interesting. But at the moment when you just think, oh, well, let's learn a little bit more about how these two got married and then why they broke up. No, then we're going to have someone attack someone else, or we're going to have someone, you know, we're going to cut scenes and then someone else is started, you know, putting something on fire. It's just amazing how, you know, there's just not a moment where you just stop to think. You're immediately interrupted by just, you know, just over the top stupidity.
Yeah, Peter Dinklage has a pretty good speech two thirds mm-hmm. of the way through, that was sort of a reaction to the stupidity that's been sort of directed at him through most of the movie. But I felt like it was, you know, it was a small token to pay for all the rest of the stuff that he has to go through. It's just, I don't know, it didn't matter at that point.
You know, he's really great. And almost everyone is, and yet the material just fails them at every point.
Yeah.
So it's funny you mentioned before, you know, we saw these two movies back to back and we saw them in the order we're talking about them. So we saw Lady Bird first, and there's this, you know, joy of seeing this wonderful movie and, you know, the excitement of thinking, oh, wow, Greta Gerwig, you know, she could be the real thing as far as a director and writer goes. And then we literally walked down the hallway of the multiplex into another theater and saw this movie. And I do think that sometimes when, you know, double features are interesting because, you know, you don't just sort of leave the first movie behind. You kind of take your experience in with you. And that can be both to the next movie's help or sometimes to its harm. And it's I don't think there's any way of you know, sort of separating the two. I don't think you can just turn that off. But it is interesting to think about, you know, whether seeing Lady Bird first made a difference. You know, what would have happened if we had seen Three Billboards first and then saw Lady Bird? You know, who knows? But I find that just sort of interesting to think about.
Yeah. There's a real art to pairing movies. Like every time mm-hmm. I see like the rep houses that have put together fantastic schedules in the cities where I've lived, it's always just like sometimes it's not clear when you see the two on paper and then you go watch them and it's like, okay, I see what they're doing here. It's like it's a black magic sometimes. There's a dark art to pairing movies. Yeah. It's really, really good. The people who do it well, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I agree. I think the most interesting or the most fruitful pairing I've ever seen was actually a triple feature I saw not long after I got to Chicago. So this is probably 20 years ago now. And it was when the Library of Congress would sort of send, you know, they have this preservation project where they preserve, is it 20 different movies a year or 25? I can't remember. But, you know, a couple dozen movies they sort of archive and make new prints. And for a while, what they would do is they would actually take these new prints and they would do a road tour with them. And so the Film Center decided to do a triple feature. And check this out. So it starts with My Darling Clementine. It goes to The Searchers, and then it ends with 2001. And that was my day, because especially, I mean, The Searchers is a pretty long movie, and 2001, of course, is epic. But it was a really fun experience because a lot of the people in the theater had done the same thing. We were all there for all three. We'd gotten tickets to all three. And there was something fun about seeing all three of these, you know, just classics on the big screen together and enjoying them together. And that was a really wonderful day of movies. I've never forgotten it. It still sticks with me.
That's a lot in one. That's a rich day.
Well, again, it wouldn't work so well, I think, if you had anything but 2001. But 2001 can hold up to being the, you know, the closing film for that trio. I remember, you know, now if you thinking about sort of double features, the same thing happens with concerts. Of course, there's opening acts and there's closing acts. In concerts, of course, the closing act is always the biggest act and they're the ones that everyone's come to see. But it didn't used to be that way. There, you know, in the 60s, I remember you'd hear about these big festivals like Woodstock and Altamont, and groups would refuse to go on last because they were afraid that people would have left already or it'd be too hard to sort of, you know, sustain the energy. And so they, you know, the big groups would insist on going either next to last or right in the middle of the set. Now, of course, it never happens, but that was, it's funny how things change that way.
Yeah, the end is important in all things. As Doug says, I saw a great show in Chicago recently. This is apropos of nothing, but it just came to mind as you're talking about closing bands. And there's a band I really like now called Big Thief. And they played at Thalia Hall here in Chicago in the round. Mm. So they were, you know, nice. In the middle of the room, and we were all gathered around, not a huge crowd, but, you know, hundreds of people, I guess. Mm. And, at first I was thinking, I don't know if I'm going to like this. Like, I don't know where I'm supposed to stand. I'm waiting for the band to come out. You know, how can I get my ideal spot if I don't know where they're going to, where are they going to be? But I ended up somehow I had the ideal spot just wherever I was. I was perfect. And, they came out and, the sound was also a little funny at first, like, because this place is not normally set up for this. It's set up for you to be performing on a stage, and all the speakers are set up there. But at this one show, they were in the middle of the room, and yet the sound of the, you know, the guitar, amplified guitars are still coming from up there. And so I thought, this is going to be weird. But the music was so great and the performance was so good that I completely forgot all of these things once it started. And it was a fantastic show. And then I was sort of reminded of them at the end when Adrienne Linker is the singer and songwriter, and she had already told us there weren't going to be encores. They leave right after this song, and everyone says, "Oh no, no!" But of course, she's going to do one last song, and she's got an acoustic guitar for this song, and she hasn't been using an acoustic guitar for most of the show, and she's playing it, and because of the strange arrangement of the speakers, she starts strumming, and she says, "Is this sounding weird to anybody else? I can't really hear myself." And everyone says, no, it's fine, keep going. And so she launches into it, sings one verse, and then after that she pauses and says, I don't know, this guitar sounded really weird. And I felt bad because she couldn't hear herself or the guitar or something. And everyone says, it sounds fine, keep going. And all she did was she put her hands out and sang the rest of the song a cappella. And they turned the lights off, and she sang them in the dark. And it was a beautiful song and a beautiful ending.
And that was the end of the show. And it was just like the most perfect end of a concert that I've seen in a long time. And if it were premeditated, I can't imagine it having been any better than that.
Oh, that's really lovely.